podcast this week, we journey to the magic faraway tree with that film's writer and director, Simon Farnaby and Ben Gregor. Plus, the usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast that lives by one simple maxim: do not pick a fight with Jack Reacher. It will not end well, folks. For you. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Empire Podcast this week. We are in the Pod booth, and I'm joined by three colleagues of such lethal cunning. Geek Queen Helen O'Hara is here.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Excellent. And just like Christmas, he comes once a year. This is his annual appearance on the podcast. Friend of the pod, podcast guru, Kobe Omanaka is here. How are you?
I'm fantastic, guys. Great to be here once again.
Yeah, I don't know. We just conjure you up once a year. Where have you come from, Kobe? What the fuck?
Today, I've just come from outside of Manchester in the northwest. Do you know the northwest? That's where Liverpool is.
I'm aware of Manchester. Yeah. I'll be going there in a couple of weeks, actually, weirdly enough.
Liverpool match.
No, very boring, but we're going on a cruise. I'm going on a holiday. I'm going on an actual holiday. And we're flying from Manchester to...
You're not going to be editing the podcast or being on the... What's going to happen?
I know. I'm leaving it in the hands of these two bozos. So who knows? You let Dougal do a funeral.
That'll be us.
It'll be that level of stuff. But it's going to be exciting. Hey, Kobe, we'll hang out. We'll go to Flight Club, play some darts.
Absolutely. Yeah, let's do it.
Even if you don't like darts. That's what we're doing. And last but not least, on the podcast, joining us in the fourth chair, or is it the third chair, or the second chair? It doesn't really matter. He's here, he's there, he's every fucking where. He is James Dyer. There's been an ongoing campaign in this podcast to give James a new nickname. It is crowdsourced. We're turning it over to the listeners of this podcast, and so far we haven't found one that sticks.
I disagree.
Which one did you think sticks?
Well, you didn't introduce me properly this week.
We're not calling you that. We're just not. You like it too much.
What is it? I can't do that. It's not good for the listeners' ears.
Someone on Blue Sky did suggest calling you Badger's Bane.
Oh.
This is from my ongoing antipathy with the local badger.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's what they've explained.
Mm. Yeah.
Badger's Bane.
Badger's Bane.
Is it the same badger? Or
like, I think it's the same badger, but he doesn't leave a calling card.
Oh, okay.
So it could be generations of badgers. He could be like the Doctor, where he kind of like
regenerates
into another badger form.
Mm. Do badgers leave calling cards like the Milk Tray Man?
It's more like the Joker.
Okay.
Yeah. It's more like the Joker. It's an agent of chaos, just wants to see my garden burn.
So Badger's Bane is very appropriate.
Badger's
in that case.
Bane! Yes. I am your garden's reckoning.
It'll be very painful.
If we're to take that Bane out, but maybe, you know, I'm warming towards Badger's Bane, but we'll keep that on the back burner, shall we?
All right. Well, listen, that is not the nickname suggestion for this week, Jimbo. Oh. You will be so sad to hear. The nickname suggestion, like this week's question, comes from Instagram. You know that thing you can do on Instagram stories where you go, hey, you put a question up, you go, ask me a question. Well, I did it for the first time this week, and we have tons of questions. I mean, so many questions. I can't even begin to count them. It's easily more than three. I have lost the one that I saw about your nickname, but it was basically someone, I don't know your name, I'm so sorry, but basically going, why did you just call him the Mad Titan and be done with it? So James, as your honorific,
yes,
it's not a nickname necessarily, it's an honorific, do you accept the Mad Titan or does the search continue?
I'll try it out for a bit. We'll see.
The Mad Titan.
We'll see.
We might have found
it. It has a certain ring to it.
It does. It does. You would, if you could click your fingers and disappear half of the world's whales, you would absolutely do that.
Half of the studio, certainly.
I had a few suggestions if I'd like to run past.
All right. Let's hear them.
I went for film and TV James's.
Sure.
Okay. Uh-huh.
Should I start with the one that I think you'll like the least or the one you'll like the most?
Oh,
least.
Definitely the one I like the least.
Okay.
Yeah. You want to build up?
Yeah. So my first one is Earthworm Jim.
Earthworm Jim. I mean...
Yes.
I'm going to say no.
It's like a prototype Iron Man.
Yeah. I've played Earthworm Jim.
Yeah.
Oh, is Earthworm Jim an actual earthworm? Yes.
A muscular earthworm with a ray gun.
So, with a Ronald Ray gun?
No.
Okay. So, if you cut Earthworm Jim in half, do two Earthworm Jims appear? Because that's famously what happens to worms.
Possibly.
We'd have to.
We don't condone that sort of thing. Obviously, on the Empire podcast, we don't condone.
I hope not.
So, the second is Jim Mini Cricket.
Okay.
I do like to think of myself as Helen in particular's conscience, so yes.
Wow. Oh, wow. Wow. Yeah. It is so the other way around. But I will accept that as long as we pronounce it Jim Mini Cricket.
Jim Mini Cricket.
Three words.
Jim Mini Cricket.
That doesn't make sense.
It just makes me laugh more, though.
Yeah, we've strayed too far off the path here.
Okay.
Yes. Mm.
Well, the last one I think you'll enjoy just be a straightforward Captain Kirk.
Oh.
No.
And then... You could be promoted and demoted depending on your performance. And so next week you could be Admiral if you perform well one episode.
Well, if he was Admiral James T. Kirk, I know what the T would stand for. So I do quite like that, actually. Admiral James T. Dyer. It does have a certain ring, doesn't it, Jimbo?
I mean, my middle name's Christopher, so...
No, but in this case, you'd have to be... Oh, jeez.
I'm willing to change it to Tiberius.
See why the T would stand for what it stands for? Yeah.
No, pedant spelled with a P.
That's spelled with a C. So we're right back around again. Okay, you've been upgraded.
Woohoo! James C. Kirk.
Oh, my God. All right, we have so many questions to get through. And if I don't read out your name, then my apologies. I will try and find it as we answer the question. Someone sent in a question about our favorite movie, Trees, because this week sees release of The Magic Faraway Tree. Mm-hmm. So you guys are unaware of these questions. I'm throwing them at you in real time. But favorite movie, Trees. Kobe, what's popped into your head? Something good, I bet.
Well, the first thing that comes to my head is The Whomping Willow. Is that what it's called? Catches the car and then...
It whomps it, doesn't it? Yeah.
It's
well
Ford Anglia, isn't it? It is a Ford Anglia.
Yes.
Yeah.
I don't know if... It's quite an aggressive choice. I was immediately like Home Tree, right?
Oh, the Home Tree is
a good choice. Soon.
That got what it deserved.
Wow. That is a monstrous thing to say. You're a monster. I think Home Tree. Whomping Willow is undeniably aggressive.
Yeah.
You know, it's got that.
You don't want your trees to be aggressive.
Well, if you're faced with Saruman, you want your trees to be aggressive. Like Treebeard.
Mm.
Yes.
Is also like he's got to be up there.
But he's a cool character. He's a chill dude. You'd like to hang out with him or even in him.
Oh, that seems wrong.
Phraseology there was a bit.
Yeah. Wouldn't you like to enter Treebeard?
No.
No?
No.
Like
no.
Just nestle in his top bush?
Does he give you the horn?
Yeah. The horn of Gondor?
Hey.
I don't like you guys.
That was a nice Tolkien joke. There was no sexual innuendo there.
We're talking Tolkien, and we will be talking Tolkien later on.
Well, it was Reading Tolkien Day on the 25th this week, because, of course, that's the day that the ring was destroyed.
And presumably you read all of Tolkien, on the 25th?
Yeah, well, in the morning, sure.
Can I just point out that the horns only appear in the extended edition, which is quite appropriate.
Explain to me the horns.
They're like the battle trees, aren't they? Only come out in the morning. It's quite weird. The horns are... I call them horns.
Yes, of course you do.
Yeah, but they're essentially like little tree soldiers, aren't they?
They're less evolved ends. Yeah, they're kind of devolved a little bit.
Okay. So, are these in the films or are these just in the books?
They're in the
extended edition.
Yeah,
they're in the extended edition films, which I've never seen. In fairness, yes. Okay, but Stephen Colbert has. But he's all over that shit.
Damn right.
All right. Well, that's exciting. So, Treebeard, that's a good one. I like the Whomping Willow, Kobe. Mm. Yeah. I'm going to go for the tree from Poltergeist.
Oh. Mm. It's been a minute.
Yeah. Oh, my God. The scary tree from Poltergeist that crashes through the window.
Oh.
And then tries to scoop up at least, I think, one of the Freeling kids. Evil tree. Don't like that tree.
When you said scary tree, my mind went to Evil Dead.
Yes.
Very scary.
Yeah, very
trees.
Scary tree. Yeah. And horrible tree.
It's probably not the best tree in two.
No.
We've literally named maybe two that could really be described as a best tree.
Well, the question was from Bad Movie Buff. I found it. Favorite movie trees. So, favorite movie trees. I don't even think I'm going to go for the Evil Dead trees as favorite movie trees. No. Although at the end of Evil Dead 2, the trees do come to life and you know, try and stomp on Ash and the cabin. So yeah, again, I'm not going for that. And do I really, is my favorite tree the one from Poltergeist? I don't know. Because that's trying to kill people as well.
Yeah. That's why home tree, like, is, you know, giving them
what
life.
Is it doing? It's just fucking sitting there doing nothing until Parker Selfridge intervenes.
A lot of what trees do.
Yeah, and they should fucking sort it out.
Well, no, maybe we should sort it out and be more tree-like, because they have been around on the planet for longer than us.
And what do they
seem to be doing?
What
okay.
do they give us?
Air?
I like that one.
I think you should mate like a tree and get out of here.
Do you have any suggestions, Jimbo?
I am Groot.
What would you say now?
Is he a tree?
Yes.
Well, he's
very
Groot.
Much a tree.
Yeah.
I would say that. Otherwise, if you want to go all low key, Idrisil, maybe. Possibly.
Oh,
that's a pretty fucking good tree.
The tree, that's a the great world tree.
Yeah, yes. That's a pretty good tree. But if we want to go less low key and more lo-fi, maybe the Shawshank tree.
Shawshank tree.
With a little box.
Buried in the roots.
Because you're thinking like actual trees that are like trees. Because my mind
as opposed to
what living talking trees that say I am Groot.
I mean, they're all trees.
I don't think Groot's a tree.
He's a fucking tree.
I'll accept Groot's a tree.
He's definitely
is he a tree.
A tree?
Yeah. I don't
he's
think he's a tree.
He's a sentient tree, but he's a fucking tree.
I don't think he's a tree. I think his species is not tree. I don't think there's that at all.
Well, hang on, but the Ents, you accepted the Ents. Why not Groot?
Because they're trees. They're clearly trees. They're trees.
They literally have like a species name and it's Ents, and they are tree shepherds, which implies that they're not trees.
How many trees do you see that look like Groot? In your everyday life.
How many
life?
Trees do you see life. Walking around like Treebeard?
Yeah.
Fucking loads. I grew up in Ireland, where all the trees come to life because of the fairies and the leprechauns.
Actually, yeah, one of those fairy trees would actually be a really good shout. You know the one that they like
Pan's Labyrinth.
built like a bypass around in the south of Ireland because nobody wanted to be responsible for uprooting the fairy tree.
Nobody wants to be responsible for uprooting the fairy tree.
I'm not even kidding. This is a thing that happened in the last 30 years.
The little folk become vengeful.
Yes, that was the thinking.
That's generally the thinking behind that. You don't want the little folk to become vengeful.
Nobody believed that the little folk would actually become vengeful, but nobody wanted to uproot the tree just in case.
Test the theory.
Yeah.
I've seen Return of the Jedi. I know what happens. They will play bongos on the stormtroopers' helmets.
Exactly. That's what would happen.
That's exactly what would happen. Return of the Jedi. So many great trees in
so
that.
Many great trees. I don't know if we can like pick the best tree.
What do you
there?
Mean? We can't pick the best tree. What about the one that they used to smash into the scout walker?
Well, that's two dead trees. Trunks, isn't it?
And they were formerly trees. Why are you being treeist?
Well, I'm being timist, I suppose. All right, fine. Yeah,
all right. So that's a good one.
What about Jerry Bruckheimer's tree? The one that represents Don Simpson and is being struck by lightning.
Oh, in the logo.
Yeah, it used to be two bolts of lightning forking, and then it became one bolt of lightning striking a tree, which we can only assume was Don.
Yes, that's a good one. And that reminds me of Back to the Future, where the Twin Pines Mall becomes the Lone Pines Mall.
Yeah. There we go.
Yeah, so that's a good one. Also, we haven't talked Christmas trees yet.
Oh.
And my word, plentiful. Plentiful area for discussion.
It's got to be vacation.
Christmas vacation.
I mean,
what an amazing tree.
Yeah, well,
it contains wildlife.
Yep, squirrel.
Yeah, briefly, yeah.
Sap, a lot of sap.
A lot of sap.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was thinking more like, I don't know, end of Home Alone 2 when they meet in front of the giant Christmas tree.
And the tree falls on the mall and kills them all.
No, no. Although it kind of almost does in. Hawkeye,
the new.
The same tree, or at least, you know, same location.
Aye.
Gigantic, impressive tree.
And again, a lot of action goes on inside that tree.
Yes.
Yeah.
Why?
Not a film, though. So are we allowing it? Are we allowing it?
Fine.
All right.
Home tree. Still sticking with home tree.
No, it's not home tree. It can't be home
tree. It's definitely home tree.
Oh, come on.
It's got dragons basically living in its branches. Come on.
God damn you. God damn you all to hell. All right. We got a lot of Project Hail Mary related questions this week. A lot of people have fallen in love with that movie. It's done incredibly well at the box office. It seems to have captured the imagination. A lot of Rocky related questions this week because everyone has fallen in love with Rocky. So this isn't about Rocky. It's a question from Follow the Lemur. This feels obvious following PHM. That's Project Hail Mary. But best item of knitwear in film. Now, this is in relation to...
This is a Knives Out question, yeah, and it is Chris Evans in Knives Out. End of question.
Chris Evans is knitwear.
Yeah, he is knitwear. That is the sexiest
Chris
jumper
Evans
that has ever been knitted.
I'm not a knitwear guy, but in that film, I'm like, I want that knitwear.
Yeah.
It is really good. I mean, look, the Fox cardigan in Project Hail Mary is also superb. And the pattern is available online, and they have now put up the altered pattern to make it into a friendlier
Ellen,
fox cardigan.
Are you saying you're going to knit one for me?
I can't knit.
I think that's what you're saying.
I will show you guys a video of my son, who's nearly 6 years old, knitting.
No way.
Genuinely, he's on a sofa watching Spider-Man and his amazing friends learning to knit. So if I give him this pattern...
Yes. Then. And we can have basically a six-year-old sweatshop knit us
Helen,
multiple
as,
Project Hail Mary cardigans.
As your lawyer, I'm going to intervene at this point in time and go, that's a great idea, but maybe off mic?
Okay.
All right. Kobe, I just want to interrogate that. So you said Spider-Man and his amazing friends.
Spidey and his amazing friends.
I was going to say, is Spidey and his amazing
that's
friends.
Correct.
So what point are you going to kind of upgrade to Spider-Man and his amazing friends, which is also on Disney Plus?
I've tried that because that was my Spidey and entry point, and he was like, he patiently watched the first episode with me, and I was like, then Dad, can we not watch this one anymore? I was gutted.
Aww.
And you were like,
Firestar and Iceman.
And then did you do the Clockwork?
Me too.
Yeah, huge. Absolutely, love those guys.
Amazing. And did you do the Clockwork? He said, no, we're watching this. Then you Clockwork Oranged him, the eyes straight open.
That is what I'll try when I get home this evening.
Again, Kobe, great idea, but off mic. just
Chris,
on that one.
As your lawyer, just saying off mic is not a great defense.
Your Honor, defense. Your Honor, that was an off mic conversation. That was totally fine and should not be admissible in court. All right, so that was dealt with very quickly. Let's move on to one more question, shall we?
Okay. I mean, there are other great pieces of knitwear, but I'm struggling right now, so I might want to wait to think about this.
The dude has great knitwear.
Yeah.
Absolutely love that one. All right, so this has come from several people, but this one's from H. Rana Ratley. These are all on Instagram. I really like this reaped rewards, this method of asking for questions. Your favorite films about smart people solving problems. And someone else, whose name I will try to find, phrased it in honor of, here we are, Stephen KT, in honor of the Emperor podcast, what are your top competent porn movies? So those movies where smart people do smart things really, really well. What's your favorite example of that? I'll throw one in right from the off. All the President's Men.
Mm. Mm-hmm. I was thinking about journalism there. So All the President's Men and what was one with?
Spotlight.
Yeah, Spotlight. I was thinking that where you just diligently go through the process.
Exactly the opposite of what I would do and how I would approach a story. And these guys get the job done. Woodward and Bernstein. Yes, please. Love that film.
Yes. The only problem is you're exposing yourself to people being really incompetent in the Nixon administration. So that's the only slight sort of caveat.
They were
taping all of the conversations.
Yeah, but that cover up, they needed to deep throat in the garage in order to unlock the conspiracy.
Fair enough.
You know, they had to really pound the pavement, those guys.
I would say almost all heist movies.
Yeah.
Obviously not all, but like the Ocean's movies, for example, those are great competence porn movies. So far, the Andy Weir movies, The Martian and now Project Hail Mary, of course, they are just, they hit
the
spot.
He does love his competent porn, doesn't he?
Apollo 13 is one of my go-tos for this as well. Apollo 13 is something unforeseen has happened, and now two groups of really smart people are going to have to figure it out. Oh, just inject it in my lungs. I just love it. Inject it in my lungs.
I was going to say, I think you might be injecting incorrectly.
Is that incompetent?
It could be.
Ellen, are you being incompetent?
I am being
right
incompetent.
Now?
What hospital do you go to?
Ironically.
Yes.
This is why I have to watch films about people being competent, you know? It's what I need. But
Smart
people being smart.
Well, no, I take issue with that. It is not just smart people being smart. It is competent people being competent. So John Wick, I would say, would qualify.
Yes.
Because he is supremely competent.
Although he's more than competent.
Well, the thing is, and this is the
difficult
thing.
There's no upper limit on competence.
Right, exactly that. Except he does need to get saved multiple times during the original John Wick, and that is that's slightly incompetent, but we gloss over that.
We've talked about this in the podcast before, but his big iconic speech, I'm thinking I'm back.
Yeah, he's tied
to a chair, about to be killed at that point.
Yeah, but importantly, is not killed.
No, because Willem Dafoe.
Yeah, Willem Dafoe is nearby, and he doesn't know that Willem Dafoe is nearby. No. So
yeah,
he's, what the fuck are you doing, John?
He doesn't.
If we're also, you know, head down this particular road, Sisu, I would say, is extreme violent competence.
Yeah. Another Ryan Gosling, actually, is Drive.
Yeah.
The man can drive.
He can drive real well. He drives good.
Yeah.
And maybe Baby Driver for the same reason.
But do you get a kick out of watching him figure
drive
things out?
Drive really well? Yes, I do. Yes.
You do? Mm. Okay. Interesting. Kobe?
My final thought is another Mark Ruffalo piece. Is the Dark Waters.
Oh, yes.
Where he just digs into what's going on behind Teflon.
More diligence.
Yeah.
Actually, also maybe A Few Good Men.
Mm. Yes.
Because, okay, there are moments of incompetence, strenuously objecting, not competence born.
I object.
But the breaking down of the case and the, you know, that's smart people working it over. And then, by extension, a lot of Aaron Sorkin stuff, and in particular, the whole of our beloved West Wing.
Yes, definitely.
I think the final one there is, well, not maybe the final one, but Marissa Tomei's character in My Cousin Vinny, where she's overlooked as... Just,
yes.
You can't know cars, and she knows cars. And
where is she from? what's going on there? Break that accent down for us, Kobe.
It's potentially very xenophobic to a lot of the world.
Brooklyn by way of Greater Manchester.
I don't know what happened there. I love that you made your point by being incompetent at something else. That was great.
I'll just get my coat.
4 hours later, I've got it, guys.
We should also mention anything that has Wolverine in it, because he's the best he is at what he does.
But what he does isn't very nice. But
true story.
You're right, yeah.
Is Steve Rogers competent porn?
Yeah.
Or is it just porn?
I mean, there is an argument
to
be made.
Does he have the beard?
I would say Infinity War, because Thanos is nothing if not competent. So.
And then he's nothing.
I mean, he comes very close
in the next film.
to fucking it up. He does put a lot of his plans in the hands of buffoons.
Yeah.
You know, fine, I'll do it myself. Then he gets his four mates to do it for him and they fuck it up.
It's delegation, so. Chris. It's efficient.
Is it though?
Yeah.
There we go. All right. So we had so many questions sent in this week. I may go back to that well again next week and get to some questions that weren't answered. But in the meantime,
I would like to think about the knitwear thing a bit more.
Mm. Helen would like to think more about the knitwear thing. But thank you so much indeed. That was a really, really fun way of getting lots of questions. May do it again. Follow me on Instagram, CTAH1976.
Follow all of us on Instagram, at James C. Dyer.
What are you, Helen?
Helen084.
Okay. Kobe?
At Copestar, KOBESTARRR.
Why did you choose that name?
Because I'm an idiot.
Yeah.
And we're back to the incompetent. Amazing. All right. Shall we talk about some movie news, folks?
Let's.
Once again, there has been some, which is good to see. This is a week, I'll be honest with you, that has been filled for me anyway with headlines that have made me glance at the calendar to check if it isn't April 1st.
Mm. Right.
One of them is not a movie thing. It was the news that Mo Salah will be leaving Liverpool at the end of the season. Mm-hmm. Yep. I was like, checking the calendar. Is this true? Oh, Christ, it is. And then I went away and I stared at the wall for a good couple of hours. And the other one is the news that there is a brand new Lord of the Rings movie that is in the works. It is called Lord of the Rings, Shadow of the Past. And it will be written by Stephen Colbert. Yes, that Stephen Colbert. Well, and
yes,
his nepo baby son, Peter McGee, and Philippa Boyens, who, of course...
Oh, so she's part of the crew,
she
at least.
Knows her way around right. The stuff. And so does Colbert, in fairness. This man has forgotten more about Lord of the Rings. He is a super, super uber fan.
He's read
of
the
Tolkien.
Unfinished Tales.
And like, he finished him. He actually finished the Unfinished Tales.
Mm-hmm. He's probably got the horn.
Yeah. He thinks that Lord of the Rings is the number one trilly. And he has written a whole song about it, and it's brilliant, and I'm going to have to watch it again.
Yes. I mean, there's a fairly strong argument for it. I'm not sure I'd necessarily ascribe to it, but it's definitely in the running. Are you a Rings hater?
I'm not a hater. I'm me and Boyd align on the Rings.
Yes, because Boyd Hilton of the Pilot TV Parish famously does not think the Lord of the Rings films are particularly good.
I could not.
Wrong.
What? That's a great. What?
How dare we?
Chris is like, who could possibly have such an opinion?
That those people should be driven out of here.
I agree.
Ideally on giant elephants.
Yeah. Timothy Oliphant.
They are films, though, aren't they? The films that exist, which are quite good for people to watch.
Yes. Yeah. People love those movies.
Because they're wonderful.
And Stephen Colbert is one of those people. But this is batshit insane news. And it was announced the other day on this Tolkien Day, Helen, I believe.
Yes, 25th March.
And he took time out from reading the Unfinished Tales to jump onto a Zoom call with Peter Jackson, who is involved with these movies. So obviously they're going to make The Hunt for Gollum. Andy Serkis is working hard on that. They're going to start filming very soon, I believe. And this is going to be the second one to follow on from The Hunt for Gollum. And this appears to have originated from Stephen Colbert, who, if you don't know who he is a huge talk show host who is about to be...
not a talk show host anymore.
He's going to find himself with some free time in his hands. His show is coming to an end in May, I believe. And over the years, he's actually in one of the Hobbit films. He's got a cameo. I think it's The Desolation of Smaug. He's got a cameo in. And he's a massive, massive Tolkien fan. And he thinks he has found a way in to tell a story that is simpatico with both the books and with Peter Jackson's original LOTR films. Helen, James, do you know what that story might be?
Helen knows.
Oh, well, a little
the
bit.
Shadow knows.
Yeah. It sort of seems to be centered around the Old Forest and Tom Bombadil. So all those Justice for Tom Bombadil types.
Yeah.
Who aren't satisfied with Rings of Power, where he's quite good.
He is, Rory Kinnear.
Rory Kinnear.
Old when the world was young.
Indeed. This is his moment, potentially.
His perfect moment.
Yeah.
This is his moment.
And it's a musical.
And it will also feature Eleanor Gamgee, who also born on the 25th of March, actually. Weirdly, it's mentioned in the books that she's born on the anniversary of the destruction of the rings, in a supporting role to Merry, Pippin and Sam.
So that means that Sam got busy 3 months after the destruction of the rings.
Well, it's not 1 year later, I don't think. It's the same day.
So it wasn't like he destroyed the ring, well, or was there when the ring was destroyed.
Yeah.
Incompetence porn, once again.
Oh, hang on. No, I'm sorry. Okay. All right. No one is calling Sam Gamgee, of all people, incompetent on my watch. Absolutely not.
Are you sure about that, Master Frodo?
Frodo put on the ring and disappeared, and he still tried to do the right thing.
Yeah.
No, that is not okay.
No.
No. Yeah. In this house, we love and respect Sam Gamgee.
Okay. Yeah.
The man can cook a tater.
He can.
Fry him, mash him,
stick him in a pot.
I mean, you know, you're like mature when you start shifting from finding Aragorn attractive to finding Sam attractive. Like, that's
really, you find, you know, Sam.
He can cook.
Yeah.
He can garden.
Yeah.
He likes, you know, long lunches and probably falling asleep afterwards.
And he definitely says he's 6 foot on Hinge.
He definitely does.
He can't carry that, but he can carry you.
There we go.
It's what you want in every man, right? All right, I take some of it back about Sam. But what I'm saying is, after they threw Gollum after they murdered Gollum and threw him into the fiery pit of Mount Doom, canonically, Sam then didn't just hightail it via giant eagle back to the Shire and get his freak on, and then 9 months later, out pops little
Why
Eleanor.
Do you think the gestation period of hobbits is 9 months?
It's a good might point. Be that's a good point.
Very good point. I'm being hobbitist. I'm sorry.
But also, of course, it's like, I'm not saying it's the 1 year anniversary. I'm just saying it's the anniversary. So you don't have to.
No, but I'm saying, canonically, it would have made sense had he been like, whoa, yeah, celebrate. That's get fucked up. Well, and he goes back to the Shire.
Look, we're not getting into the whole scourging of the Shire thing right now.
Is that what it's called?
Oh, boy.
Jesus Christ.
He gets his prancing pony on. No,
it was like the aristocrats. Genuinely,
come on.
It was. You've never seen anything like it.
And Merry and Pippin are inside a massive talking fucking tree, and they're leaping from branch to branch. Oh my god! And there's a massive horn.
And the fucking and the sucking and the.
And then Gilbert Gottfried comes in and says, "Oh my god! There's a giant tree." It's fucking the hobbits. The hobbits are fucking the dwarfs. The dwarfs are fucking the elves. All
and the wizards and their sleeves and
Oh my god. The aristocrat.
A wizard is never early, nor is he late. He comes precisely when he means to.
This is all being cut. This is all being cut, or I'd remind you that that's a 20-year-old documentary that nobody saw in the first place.
Whoa. We saw it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We keep the flame flying.
That's right.
Can you fly a flame? Yeah, let's go for it. Anyway, so Helen, you don't think that these are chapters that Peter Jackson ignored. So is there something cinematic in here?
I mean, maybe. I hope so. I think there could be something cool. I don't know. I'm just honestly pleased that Stephen Colbert is getting to live out his Tolkien super nerd dreams. I don't have any strong opinion on this beyond... well done him. And that may change. You know, I may be like, this film may emerge and I may be like, oh my God, this is the greatest thing ever.
Yeah.
At the moment, you know, hand on heart, does it feel like it doesn't need to exist? Yes. But I'm just really pleased that Stephen Colbert gets to do this, you know?
Yeah.
If they offered you the chance to make your own, you know, Evil Dead with Sam Raimi, like, what are you going to do, you know?
I would say there are better people for the job. When can I start?
Exactly, you know, yeah. And he's better than we are. So, like,
who's better than we are?
Stephen Colbert is better than
Where's
we are.
Your
he's
proof?
A better person than we
he
are.
He was in Bewitched. I don't think that's necessarily.
I don't think that's his biggest achievement. I don't think that's like top of his LinkedIn page. You know, I think maybe like hosting the Oscars, hosting the is it Tonight Show? I forget which one. Hosting that show he does.
Yeah,
being Stephen Colbert show. Is yeah. probably mm-hmm. like a bigger deal.
He's a very, very smart and very, very capable man.
He is
competent porn. And I choose to be optimistic about this. Mm-hmm. Every day is Christmas Eve. And I'm sure he and his prolific screenwriter son will bring this home. With Philippa Boyens, of course,
exactly.
who knows her way around a ring.
And also, I mean, you're calling him a Nepo baby.
Many I didn't
nepo
say
babies,
that.
You did. Many Nepo babies are mad talented.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we can't rule out the possibility that this is going to be awesome.
Frodo was a Nepo baby.
Nepo nephew, but yeah.
It's still the same thing.
Nephew baby.
Yeah. Nepo baby doesn't necessarily mean, in my eyes, that you're the son or the daughter of the famous
true,
person.
That's
you could
true.
Be connected familially to them.
Nepotism is wider than
absolutely. Yeah.
Bond.
Nepo Baggins. That's all I'm saying. Anyway, that'll be out at some point. We're looking forward to that. A couple of things that are hitting the small screen. I know I don't want to turn this into the Pilot TV podcast, but very interesting and exciting news from the world of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. First of all, it was confirmed this week, much, I'll be honest, to my surprise, that Wonder Man is getting the second season.
It is.
Yeah. Who saw that coming?
As confidently unpredicted by James on our Wonder Man spoiler special.
I really didn't think they would, and I very much hope they wouldn't, and yet, here they are. And it's not because I think it's terrible, I just think it worked well as a very nice little one-and-done thing. I'm not sure that there's scope for them to do something else, but who knows? Maybe it'll be wonderful.
Hey, that's very good.
I mean, I really loved the idea and the sort of tone that they were going for with the last season. I just didn't think that they kind of executed it brilliantly.
Yeah.
I feel like there's potential for this kind of hangout, superheroing around the edges kind of a idea to be cool. For me, that film or that show didn't quite nail it last time. Mm. So maybe season two will nail it. Now, the problem is, of course, that all that kind of hanging about and being undercover and trying to hide the fact that you have powers seems to now maybe be...
Spoiler alert.
Judging by the end of the series, might be a bit more difficult.
Yeah, I would say so.
So that's going to be, I guess, can you still get some of that tone that I'm really interested in, you know, while carrying on the story? That's going to be, I guess, the challenge.
Maybe less of the Hollywood satire and maybe more of an actual out-and-out superhero thing.
Yeah.
I don't know. Kobe, did you watch Wonder Man?
I only watched the first episode, so I'm quite excited that there's going to be a second season, which means at least there's some air of... they feel it was on the right trajectory, which is good. Not like She-Hulk, for example, which...
Oh.
There's lots of things which have fallen by the wayside.
Give her a second season, you shits.
Yeah. Part of me just thinks they seem to have had the right idea of consolidating what they're doing and not doing spreading themselves too thin. And my initial thought was, is this going back to the spreading themselves too thin where they could focus elsewhere and make everything they're putting out like amazing? And I'm...
Maybe. It's interesting because not many Marvel shows have got a second season. In fact, this is Only the second, really. Loki got a second season.
Agatha's spin-off-ish.
It's Agatha's a spin-off. It's not technically a second season of WandaVision. So, yeah, this is interesting. And, of course, Daredevil. We're literally in second season of Daredevil right now. So stop writing in. Speaking of Daredevil, we've been asking. Daredevil Born Again Season 2 has literally just started on Disney+. Our supported special for Episode 1 is up right now, folks, if you want to listen to that. And we've been asking where Frank Castle is, quite frankly, where John Bernthal's Frank Castle, who is a big part of season one, where he is, what's he doing? And now we will have our answer because it was announced that The Punisher, One Last Kill, we knew that John Bernthal was shooting a limited edition kind of TV movie, but we didn't know when it was going to drop. Now we know it's going to drop after Daredevil Born Again season two finishes. It's going to be dropping in May. Which will set him up nicely for his appearance / cameo in Spider-Man Brand New Day. It's called The Punisher, One Last Kill. Immediately made redundant by the fact he's showing up in the next in the next thing Marvel do. But yeah, it could be interesting.
Well, but in that one, you've got Spider-Man stopping him from killing anybody.
Yeah. Yeah.
So maybe it literally is his last kill. Who knows?
Yeah, you don't kill people in PG-13.
No one has ever died.
Never. No one has ever died.
Frank's competent, isn't he? He's a very competent guy. Matt Murdock's competent.
Yeah?
Yeah?
Yeah.
Well,
this may be why I like the MCU so much, because it's just lots of people being competent and porny. That's it. Anything else happening in the world of movie news?
Well, there was a Moana trailer.
Make way.
Make way for the Rock with an extraordinary wig.
Yeah.
The wig has caused a lot of consternation online. There was a fantastic comment from Weird Al going, look, stop sending us headshots. We're not casting a weird sequel right now. But it's not Weird Al-esque as wigs go.
He's playing, of course, this is a live-action adaptation of Moana.
Moana, yeah. Yes.
Yeah. And he is reprising
the role of Maui.
Is this the first time this has happened in Disney's much-fonted, much-loved live-action animation adaptation series?
James Earl Jones, yeah. I guess, technically.
James Earl Jones. This is CNN.
Yeah, is it? Right, okay, yes.
Yeah.
But I think he's the first. Is he the only, I think? But anyway, this, you know, does it need to exist? No.
There's a lot of hate for this, which I don't fully understand, because it feels like if you were to tell me what a live action Moana would look like with The Rock reprising his role as Maui, I can't think that it would look any different to this. Like, that wig is exactly what the wig should broadly be if he is playing with his own proportions, Maui. So
yeah.
I don't know.
I think you could get a better wig.
I'm pushing past him in the wig, though, because I mean, some shots are hilarious, but the point is, it looks exactly like the CGI generated animation, apart from the fact it's got real people in it.
Yes.
And I feel that makes it a bit more redundant than the other ones. Lilo and Stitch, I think, was a great version of it because you had them in real places. You had real backgrounds happening, but here they are on the volume, they're clearly not anywhere in
the sea.
Yeah, some of the shots are quite jarring in that respect. And then other ones, they do seem to be on location somewhere. Mm. So,
the chicken looks like the chicken from the
animation. Looks like the chicken, yeah. I think, the problem with this is, look, we as obviously just in our job, we're going to go see it. Mm. You know, Kobe, you as a parent
are going to go see it.
Like everybody with kids, they're like, we're going to go see this. And this is why they keep making them. They keep making loads of money. But at the same time, I think it is legitimate, even if you have a small child that you know will love it, even if, you know, it is your job to go and see this, to be thinking, where are the new things? Make the new things. And we keep getting this. And certainly, you know, I wrote, I think, accidentally 3 reviews of these in a row last year and basically kept saying the same thing. It's like, this is too similar to the animation. We need to do more with this.
This is Alanis-level irony that you repeated this argument as well.
You know, and at this point, it makes it look like Kenneth Branagh's Cinderella was a high point of originality and trying to do something different with material, because pretty much all of the ones since then have stuck
Cruella.
Slavishly.
Cruella, I'd say.
But Cruella isn't a direct remake.
No,
it's at least a spin.
Mm-hmm. The Jungle Book, I feel, is my favourite of the remakes.
Right.
This one is directed by Thomas Kail, who directed Hamilton on Broadway. He is not throwing away his shot. It looked fine. I'm slightly with James. I know where you're coming from, and I get it, and I feel exactly the same way. But we have it, so we might as well judge it on its own merits.
Yeah, and it
looks fine.
It looks fine.
Mm-hmm. Catherine Legea, I believe, I'm not sure how you pronounce it, is playing Moana. I'm sorry if I've mangled that. Yeah, looks good.
Yeah, she looks good.
Everyone seems to be doing what they need to do, and could be good. Of course, famously, of course, I've never seen Moana, so this could be my first...
You've missed out.
Please watch Moana first. Moana's good.
Yeah.
Please you like, watch it first.
You
it's
like
really
Hamilton.
Good.
You like, I like Moana, Moana too. Music.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
I presume. Are there going to be any new songs helmed by him?
Almost certainly.
And if he's done, then that's reason enough to go.
They will try desperately to win the best original song Oscar next year. Which I hope will be sewn up for Power Ballad. But anyway, that's moving on. There was another trailer, a couple of trailers this week, but there was one that caused quite a kerfuffle online. It was, of course, Harry Potter.
And speaking of remakes that don't need to exist. Let me just be very honest. I mean, obviously, like, politically, morally, I don't love that this is happening. Okay, let's just leave that said. I thought the kids are charming. I thought they look like they're doing a great job. God bless them all. I hope they get no hate whatsoever and nothing but love and support, because they are not, they shouldn't be tainted with this in any way if it goes badly or wrong or people are protesting it or anything else. It's not their fault. It looks like Harry Potter. I don't know what to tell you. It looks like the same thing we've already seen. My bigger worry is not the trailer itself. It's the fact that the head of HBO has suggested they will be making one season of this, 8 episodes a season, every 2 or 3 years. They're suggesting it's going to be like with kids. They have said this week.
Have they?
They've said it's going to be like one of the, it's unrealistic to expect a season a year, that this is going to be one of their showcase shows like House of the Dragon, etc., that take longer than that to make because they involve dragons and zombies and so on, and that this is going to be, they've suggested, at least they haven't given a firm time frame, but they suggest it's going to be more like once every 2 years.
That's 21 years.
I'm really
years
looking
or
forward
so.
To it.
It's like 14 that's years.
Deathly
seven.
Hallows, when like Harry is like 45 and like chain smoking cigarettes. Like, it's going to be an interesting take.
Yeah.
That seems bananas to me. At the very least, you know, shoot that the live action stuff one year at a time.
That's
even
so
if you
bizarre.
Have to bank it and, you know, do your VFX later, it is incredible to me that that would be their approach.
This is the HBO Harry Potter series, which nobody asked for, but it's happening anyway. And this is the first trailer for it. And the first season is going to be out at the end of the year, and it's going to be Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone, and it looks almost identical to the film. So,
by necessity.
Someone said, we were talking about this in the office, and someone said that's because all the Harry Potter merchandise and Harry Potter studio tour, etc., is all so keyed to the design of the films that they can't color outside the lines.
Yeah. But like Nick Frost's Hagrid doesn't look a million miles away from Robbie Coltrane's. Mm-hmm. The Sorting Hat looks like the Sorting Hat. The Hogwarts looks like Hogwarts. I get why they've done it. They can't like retool the whole of the Universal Studios sub-Potter section to fit this particular template. That wouldn't make any sense. It's been quarter of a century since the first Harry Potter film. So it's been a while, right? So like if you're talking remakes, like it's not that out there to remake it at this point. And there is a lot of material in the books, I mean, certainly in the later books when they're really fat, that don't make it into the films. And like, I saw a lot of people on TikTok and Instagram like getting really excited at the nuggets in this trailer of scenes that are famous in the books which don't make the films. And they get really, you know, thrilled about these moments, especially kind of the pre-Hogwarts, Harry at school moments, things like that. It's been a very long time since I've read those books, so I genuinely don't remember any of that. But I'm interested to see, like, it has a very different vibe. It doesn't have that very kind of hyper-real, very cinematic sheen that the films do. Like, it feels much more television, and I don't mean that as an insult, but it feels like it has a very different cast to it, and I don't mean literal cast. Like, I mean like a visual cast to it. It has a very different tonality, a different palette to it, and it has a different vibe to it as well. And you can even tell from the trailer that from a pacing point of view, it feels like it's going to be more, I mean, pensive is maybe a little bit generous, for it is Harry Potter after all. But I like the idea of it being a more thoughtful, deliberately paced bit of storytelling.
The thing that makes it most interesting to me is that HBO are doing it. Had it been Disney Plus, for example,
so they could swear.
so they could swear. Please don't say fuck. But I think that's where you're getting at in terms of the pacing, in terms of the deliberate nature of it. I think that's the interesting place.
I know what you mean. And look, HBO do tend to do a very good job of most of the things they do. But for me, it is just long form versus short form storytelling. Mm. And like, I often think, like, if you're going to do a book adaptation, even though like, the first book is not long.
Yeah, but had it been on Paramount Plus where
I wouldn't throw shade at Paramount Plus. Like, they've done some good IP work, they've done some bad IP work. But some of the stuff they've done well, they've done very well. And Disney Plus, again, you know, I think what I would say from what you're saying is like HBO have a much better hit to miss ratio.
100%.
So that gives you certainly more faith in it. Also, this is arguably Warner's most valuable IP it fundamentally is the most valuable IP they have.
Yeah.
So they are heavily incentivized not to fuck this up.
Well, we shall see what happens. That's a big surprise because they had said previously it was going to be one season per year for the next 10 years.
Yeah, which makes sense.
Because these kids are going to outgrow their roles.
Look,
unless we are going to get Harry Potter and the male pattern baldness. Or
Harry Potter.
Harry Potter and the sudden shooting pains up the left arm. I'm looking forward to that.
Look, it would make sense to me if they would at least shoot the human bits, you know, one a year. But the interview that the head of HBO, I think it was, gave this week suggests that they're certainly looking at releasing them on a much more languorous schedule.
That means they're going to recast?
They talked about it on the original films.
They genuinely will have to if they don't do what Helen suggests, I would suggest. Like, there's no way you could do a season every 2 or 3 years and not recast.
Okay.
By the time you get to the end. Otherwise, it's just...
Middle is the problem. The middle where they're meant to be 14 and they're already 20. That's the issue. Yeah.
Like, you're a wizard, Harry. I know.
Sorry.
I know. Anyway, we shall see what we shall see with that one. All right, so let's have some guests now, shall we?
Let's
do it. So the Magic Faraway Tree opens this week. It is based on the series of novels, Hellspells?
Yeah.
By Enid Blyton, about a magic faraway tree. Is it obvious I haven't seen this film
yet? It's a little obvious.
Okay.
Yes, it's about a magic tree that has like magical lands that you can get to by a ladder at the top of the tree. So you like climb this ladder and then you can go to the land of birthdays.
Mm. Oh, that's a much better tree than any of the ones we said.
Yeah. It's a big tree as well. It's not small. Mm. It's far away.
Hey.
There we go.
That's true.
That is, it's very true. And this is directed by Ben Gregor and is written by and also sees an appearance by the wonderful Simon Farnaby, who you will know, of course, from the Paddington movies and from Ghosts and from Horrible Histories and Wonka. Yonderland and Wonka and all that good stuff. We love Simon Farnaby on this podcast. And Alex Godfrey was the lucky chap who got to speak to Simon and Ben on Zoom just the other day. Haven't heard this yet, but apparently no one died, so that's good.
Hurrah!
Hurrah! Here's Simon Farnaby and Ben Gregor. Enjoy.
Hi, guys. Hi, Ben. Hi, Simon.
Hello.
Hello.
Welcome. Welcome to this conversation. Welcome to the Empire Podcast. That's what this is.
Great. It's good to be here.
You both have different for the listeners, I guess you're both in your separate homes. This is a virtual call. Is that, Simon, is that a Mindhorn poster?
It is. I just realised it's there. I mean, it's not like an advert for Mindhorn. It looks like it's sort of placed.
It is literally an advert for Mindhorn.
Well, it is a poster, I suppose. Yes, this is in my ramshackle sort of spare room. I need to hang that up on that wall. And I don't have a faraway tree poster yet, so I can't hang that up.
Yeah, I mean, if this was a junket, you'd have beautiful magic faraway tree.
Well, you would think they'd have sent us one, and that would be our background.
Oh, some people. Ben, I like Ben. You seem to have some children's artwork.
I've got children's artwork. I've got some old skateboards.
Oh yes,
on the wall.
You're a keen skater.
I'm a bit more of hobbling old man now, but I've spent the years of my life with mobility on a skateboard. Yeah.
Okay. It's great to talk to you both together. Because you go way back, you two, don't you? You've worked together years ago, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've done lots of comedy stuff
first
together.
First time was, actually, someone at the premiere said, I enjoyed you in Blake's Junction 7.
Yeah.
Which was a short film we did with Tim Plesser about 25 years ago, I'm going to say.
Oh, that's a lot. I don't know. It's not 25. It's 20. 20 years ago. Yeah, that where we, Simon was a very grumpy server of fish and chips to Martin Freeman, and so slopped the fish and the peas down on his canteen tray very well.
So we go that far back.
Yeah.
The first book, I think, was published in 1939, top of my head.
That's right.
So getting on, you know, getting on for 90 years now, and it's boggling that it hasn't been made into a film before. But then when you think about it, there are reasons why. When it came to both of you separately, did you both instinctively see the challenges there, or did you just see the opportunities?
I saw the opportunity, really. I was actually reading the stories to my daughter, who was then 3 or maybe 4, and I'd been reading them, and she really laughed a lot. Even actually when I didn't know why, I was going, this is so, what, the guy can't hear and he mispronounces things, like, but she'd be howling. And I would go, okay, I guess that's funny. And taught me a lot, actually, when it came to writing a screenplay. But so when Pippa and Danny Perkins came with and said, do you want to sort of pitch for it, or do you have an idea? I knew comedically that all the characters would be great. And, you know, I suppose having worked with, you know, slightly surreal, like the Mighty Boosh, you know, had crazy characters and was funny. And, you know, and I thought you could do something really colourful and, like, surreal, but with these family-orientated characters. You know, you got a fairy and you got a guy with a moon head. And so immediately I was like, they're fine. I was never worried about those characters in a way. And the lands, the way the challenge was marshalling it all into a coherent story for modern families, like, as well, that was the other thing. Never wanted it to be set in the 30s or 40s, so that was a challenge. And then hitting on the idea of sort of just some modern kids who were probably into their screens more than playing felt like a good routine, and that was their journey, and it went from there.
Yeah, everyone I know who grew up reading these books remembers the vibe of it, the feeling of it, and the characters. No one remembers what happened. You know, no one remembers the stories because I haven't really gone back to read them, but, you know, as Simon, as we've spoken about before, there aren't really big stories. It's just, they're just sort of things that happen, you know, up this tree with these people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I believe from conversations I've had with some of you that, it was really interesting finding out how Enid Blyton apparently wrote, which was to just write as if there was no tomorrow and never look back and never rewrite and never edit. And I guess there are pros and cons there, because on the one hand, it means you have this really free sort of fanciful flow of things going on. But on the other hand, there's not a lot of consistency. I think when I spoke to Nicola Coughlin, who plays Silky, she was saying, you know, in the first book, I think Silky's maybe a pixie, and then suddenly later she's an elf because Enid Blyton never looked back to see what she'd written. So that's interesting. It'd be interesting to talk to you about how you grappled with that. I mean, did you feel like you just had to almost start fresh with a solid foundation for what this film could be over the course of, you know, 100 minutes or so?
That, you're right in all those things, and the characters actually change, and they're all generally sort of quite nice, and so we had to really sort of delineate the characters. And this is I don't want to take away from Enid Blyton, because the characters are very vivid, but they're all sort of quite jolly and nice. And so we had to add a bit of jeopardy. Well, there is a bit of jeopardy in the stories, like you have to get out before the land turns. Otherwise you're stuck there, which is bad. But and Ben always had great ideas about Silky, because I sort of was going, well, Silky should fly around the place, and Ben was always keen that she'd be to get an actress. You know, we were lucky enough to get Nicola, who would just be sort of human size, and then we ended up sort of using that. So it was a bit of to and fro with me and Ben, and going, so we were almost making it up as well as we went along.
I think that I was really keen for the tree gang being genuinely bonding with the kids and having the kids really feel comfortable around them. And as soon as you get into, you know, tiny, tiny pharaohs the entire time or people with giant VFX heads for Moonface, you know, you're instantly setting the kids back into a technical process and they can't muck around. The whole dancing before they went up the tree, I think we thought of that the day before, you know, and we're like, oh, let's make some gramophones into, yeah, into like a DJ table on sewing machines. Let's like dance. Let's go crazy. Let's let's not just queue up and go up the ladder. You know,
sorry,
and
you mean literally the day before? The day before?
I think it was very, very just before.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, no, we had no plans for it and no choreography.
I didn't know anything about it.
Yeah. Yeah, because I was just like, I was blocking, I was like planning the day. I used to get up very early and plan at about 4 a.m. And I was like, and then they queue up and go up the ladder. I was like going, how on earth am I going to shoot this to look interesting? And like, that's not what it should be. It should be more exciting. Like, Wachalot doesn't wash clothes. She's the keeper of a portal to adventure. She's the kind of lackadaisical gatekeeper of like risk and adventure. And like, she should like put on a tune and like, let's go create and let's dance. And like, and then Silk, like, you know, at the beginning they go, we all hate dancing, you know, and then, you know, and Billy, you know, who's playing Fran, nods like grave solemnly, you know, the solemnness that kids get when they've been on screens too much. I'm so serious. But, and then you've got like Nicola teaching her a dance, which we made up on the spot. And you know, that stuff doesn't happen if someone's right. You're just dancing to an eyeline and you're doing it later, you know, and Moonface like spun and he did his back in. Actually, he did a spin and did like kind of a thing. I was like leap off the ground when the beat hits. And he's going, I can't not do that again. You bastard, I can't move. And I'm like, okay, no more close-ups of Moonface. I think we got it. And they were doing this dance and you know, and it suddenly became this like really, really vibrant coming out of the shell of Fran. And so I wanted the lands, the sets, the, you know, the characters to be so present and vivid for the kids. It's because you see it in the kids' eyes. You can't fake that. And Harry Potter, some of our VFX team worked on the Harry Potter films, and they said, you will not believe how much money and time was spent on just realigning the kids' eyeballs, because they would just drift off, and because they were so bored, they had nothing to look at. There were no dragons, obviously. There was nothing to see, you know, in Harry Potter, a lot of it. So the kids were just bored and they were just looking all over the place, and they had to like make them look in the same direction. So they VFX their eyeballs for hundreds and hundreds of thousands, you know, and we didn't have to do that because we had the kids were just like, whoa, that's cool. Wow. And we were like, you can eat the set. You know, like you can eat and drink it all. It's all real. The people are there. Like, let's dance. Let's muck about. Let's play games. Let's have a spaghetti race. That we thought of that on the floor because we had this meal that was going to be like, oh, the family are really bonded and they're all tired and it was really boring. And we shot the most boring, boring scene of everyone just eating in silence. I was like, hey, this is the exact opposite. And then we were just like, spaghetti race. And then suddenly it became a scene. You know, and it's like, because the kids were there and they were doing stuff. So it was very, very important to create all of the character design, all of the set design and schedule around what the kids would find interesting and fun, and not in a shallow way, because it was about a family reigniting passion for living and each other. Yeah. So if you can't fake that without looking like you're creating some kind of cult video or something.
One of the most interesting updated things you had to wrangle, I guess, I think, is with the character of Dame Snap, played in the film by Rebecca Ferguson, who, you know, as we know, and people who have read the book might remember, they'd have to be very old, but originally in the books, she was called Dame Slap, because we lived in different times, or they lived in different times, where physically punishing children was okay. And yeah. So you have a character in the Enid Blyton books who slapped the kids, I guess. I can't remember. I mean, did she do it in the book? Did she actually slap children in the original books?
Plenty of slapping, isn't there?
Plenty of slapping.
Yeah. But
that was galore.
Yeah, she was. It was quite recent. It was changed to Dame Snap, right. I think. Yeah. I don't remember reading.
That really was last minute, that stuff. I mean, with the things that we were talking about with Dame Snap were, I mean, up to the day pretty much when we were going crazy. Do you remember some of the stuff we were coming up with?
Oh, trying to work out how to do it. I know. And I think there's a couple of bits that are playful from my point of view anyway.
Like, do you remember the Kenny Everett hands?
Oh, yeah.
For a while, I was like, no, let's call her Dave Slap. But she would be fine because she's had giant Kenny Everett hands. And then you were like, they should be really long.
That's right.
And we were like trying to pitch it because Simon and I would have these things. The producers were brilliant. They're so lovely and supportive. This wasn't a studio picture. This was a 100% independent film. But Simon and I would still pitch our ideas to them, you know, because we had to have so many ideas. So many of how we would do everything, right? So we think we work this out, and they go, right. And most of the time we went, okay, that sounds great, actually. But sometimes they're like, we're not sure.
Yeah, I mean, the Silky is a good example as well, because as I say, I was like, I really think she should be small, but I was glad in a way we didn't have enough money to make her small. And as Ben said, the kids could react to her and have Beth have a friendship and you get to feel it on the screen. But there is a little bit when she is a tiny, she gets her wish and she's a tiny, which looks...
We did do it. Lovely, we had to scratch that itch. I mean, so she is an elf in the book. We had fun with that.
So the restriction in a way was a good thing.
Definitely.
And that we could have had too much of her being a tiny.
And to your question about Snap and Slap, you know, what we did do was we referenced it. You know, she said, you know, I used to be called Dame Slap, you know, and like until the school inspector came, you know, and it's just really great because we sort of.
He does it brilliantly as well.
She does it brilliantly. And Tom Meaton with her does it brilliantly. Yeah. That scene that, you know, we you can be a little bit tongue in cheek. You can be a bit knowing about the kind of like the changes and the context and have fun with the historical context. You don't have to be all worthy. It's not like we're making it like worthy, and it's like it's sad to be modern and we're all woke and boring. It's like it's just let's just enjoy the fact, let's enjoy it, let's let the actors play with it, and let's go for it. I mean, that was another last minute thing. Her song, Teddy Bear's Picnic, was very, very last minute. And I was like, it'll be fine, everyone, because it's free. And it wasn't. It wasn't free. So,
oh, really?
No, it's owned by, I mean, it's like Happy Birthday only stopped being free, only became free like about 3 years ago. That's why in movies you'll go, to you, because that's the only amount of the song you can do without paying loads of money. Whereas now you can do it, they finally. But Teddy Bear's Picnic, which I am amazed by, because there are like recordings of it in 1920, they were like, it's not free at all. And I'm like, oh shit, oh well,
yeah,
right. Sorry, but it's funny.
Let me talk briefly about one of the new characters in the film, which Simon is your character, the farmer and sort of landlord of this barn that the family move into. I think, if I remember, you told me that he was inspired by a farmer on or someone on Clarkson's farm, which I hadn't seen before, you told me, and I did look him up. And it is quite uncanny. He really does talk in a language that seems like it was invented by Tolkien or something. Had you just happened to see? Were you watching it at the time?
No, I was writing Wonka 2 with Paul King, and Paul had a look over the script. We swapped scripts, and Paul went, you know, you should play a, you know, what about a farmer character like as a local, you know, give a bit of context to where the family are going. And he showed me a clip of that. So I've never actually seen an episode. He showed me a YouTube multi-clip, you know. Multi-clip montage. it's a new word for you, a multi-clip. I believe it's called a montage. Anyway, of that guy. And I thought he was hilarious. And also, it's a good way of not having to learn any lines. And then actually, well, we probably can't talk about the end of his storyline. But
no, let's not.
But there is an Easter egg. There is an Easter egg.
There is, yes.
That's I say to the viewers, the wonderful potential viewers.
Like,
yeah, it's not. Yeah. You have to wait long.
Simon, did you study him on TV to get that voice right, or did you just do your own version of it?
Oh, I mean, it's a very natural thing for me to do very stupid voices and accents, you know, having done Horrible Histories and worked with Ben. And so as soon as I saw it, I knew, I went, oh, yeah, I can do that. There's no problem. And that's no problem at all. Ah.
Yeah, I remember giving, I was like, more gibberish.
Ben was saying when we filmed that, he was going, yeah, I can understand too many words and you need to be more speak more gibberish.
Well, look, thank you. We have to wrap up, but thanks for that. I love the nuttiness of the film. And like I say, the emotion is unbelievably moving and heartwarming and just so much fun. I absolutely love the film. And also, it's nice to have had this chat and to have learned a new word. I'm going to be using multi-clip.
I know. This might end up in a multi-clip.
Yeah, let's hope so. Okay. Thanks a lot, both of you.
Thanks, Alex. Good to talk to you again.
Thanks, Alex.
Okay, that was Simon Farnaby and Ben Gregor talking about The Magic Faraway Tree. And now it is time to open the reviews section of the show and talk about what is available for you to watch this week in the multiplexes and indeed on your sofa plexes. Although I think it's all multiplexes this week, right?
Yep.
Yeah, good stuff. I will say on Disney Plus this week, we'll review it next week, is the new film from Ben David Grabinski called Mike and Nick and Nick and Alice, and it is a timey-wimey action comedy starring Vince Vaughn and James Marsden and Isaac Gonzalez, and it's well worth your time. But we'll review it properly next week. That's on your Sofaplex. In the multiplex, The Magic Faraway Tree, Hell's Bells.
Yes, so we have a family who are led by Andrew Garfield and Claire Foy as the parents, and their three children played by Delilah Bennett-Cardi, Phoenix LaRoche, and Billy Gadsden, who are kind of disconnected from each other, right? You know, the mother has just quit her corporate job on a point of principle, and they decide to move away to the country in the hope that being in a more rural environment can bring them together as a family. The parents are going to start their own business, and the kids, it is hoped, will spend less time on their screens and more time talking to one another and their parents. This causes some consternation, obviously, on the kids' parts as they move to the country. The youngest girl, Fran, that's the Billy Gadsden character, in particular, like literally hasn't been speaking. She's just like given up on life a little bit. But she kind of blossoms pretty quickly in the country, not least because she sees a fairy in the forest, the Enchanted Wood nearby. She goes looking for this fairy who is Nicola Coughlan Silky and finds the magic faraway tree and then leads it, you know, in the style of Lucy and Narnia, leads her brother and sister there as well. And they all go on magical adventures faraway tree, that kind of thing. There is actually a land of candy that they go to, yes. And they meet like Nonzo and Ozzy's Moonface, Saucepan Man, who's Dustin Demery Burns,
yes,
et cetera, et cetera. Oliver Crisp is involved. I find this a bit of a film of two halves. I think the family stuff is very grounded and very sweet and very, without being schmaltzy, you know, but just really well-intentioned, really sincere. There is, you know, a struggle, I think, to maintain connection as your kids get a little bit older. You know, these kids are like, probably like 13, 14, maybe 12 and 10, something like that. So they're just getting to that point of kind of stopping talking to their parents, and their parents are feeling a bit left out, but also worried about, you know, are the kids still talking to each other? Like, are they okay? And I get that. I think all of that works really well. And of course, Claire Foy in particular is fantastic at just empathy and warmth and everything else. Andrew Garfield, I was a little bit up and down on sometimes. I think sometimes he's great here and sometimes he's cartoonish. Anyway, my problem is I think there's a bit of a disconnect between that and the rather pantomime characters up the tree. And it's something that Simon Farnaby has tried to kind of, you know, calm down a little bit from the books and give them thoughts and their own desires and their own, you know, character in a way that the books really don't, if we're honest. I mean, look, don't get me wrong. I loved Enid Blyton as a kid. My dad had to institute a rule that I was not allowed to only get Enid Blyton books out of the library. I had to also get something else. So I was in the tank for her as a kid, and I get it. But at the same time, like, he can't quite get past the fact that these are ridiculous characters doing ridiculous things. And I think, it for me, it created a disconnect that made this not quite as good as a Paddington or a Wonka or something like that. So I liked it. I think it's charming. I think it's incredibly well intentioned. I think the kids are really lovely. I think the warmth is all there, but it didn't quite work. It was very much a film of two halves for me.
All right, Jimbo.
I kind of have to respectfully recuse myself from this review because while I was present, I did sleep through 30 minutes of the film.
Jesus,
which
Christ.
In many ways sums up how I felt about it. It is quite charming. It is quite whimsical. The production design is glorious and it looks beautiful. But it is, I think it's fair to say, quite plot light. And while I don't understand the whole. It's the new Paddington. It's not the new Paddington.
No,
it has some of the kind of twee charm that Paddington has, definitely. It doesn't have any of the, I think, you know, the lovable characters in the same way. It doesn't have Paddington himself. But yeah, I wasn't hugely engaged and then become asleep for about 30 minutes.
Why did you fall asleep? Was it just a long journey?
To be fair, a combination of tiredness and boredom. So I'm so sorry. So I will not render a verdict on this one because I missed 30 minutes of the film.
Oh boy.
All right, so we gave this one 3 stars?
Yes, I wrote that review so that it does reflect my opinion.
Helen was conscious all the way through the film.
I was conscious the whole way through.
And that's important.
All right, so
I would say as well, Rebecca Ferguson is in it as a sort of...
Oh, you, Rebecca?
Baddie. She's awesome, so it's really hard getting past the Rebecca Ferguson-ness. Yeah, I would imagine.
All right,
But yeah.
3 stars then for the film, 5 stars for Rebecca Ferguson.
Correct, always, yes, always.
As with everything she is in. And James, how many seds would you give us out of...
Oh, definitely 5.5 seds.
40 winks then from James Dyer. You absolute disgrace of a man.
Sorry, maths was never my strong suit.
Oh my God. All right, so 3 stars then for The Magic Faraway Tree. Kobe?
They will kill you.
Yes, man. they will kill you.
So this follows... Zazie Beetz character Asia as she's estranged from her sister after a quite tumultuous start. She's estranged from her sister and ends up in prison for just under a decade where she acquires amazing skills in a John Wick-esque style. She learns how to fight, basically.
Most people just don't know how to, get their diploma in prison. So this is quite good.
She got a diploma in kicking ass.
Andy Dufresne didn't run this workshop in Shawshank.
When she comes out of prison, she goes to find her sister. And her sister has been located in a building called the Virgil. When she turns up, chaos of many different magnitudes ensues. This is gory. This is funny. I had a few qualms with the film as it got towards the end, particularly. But we have Patterson Joseph, Patricia Arquette, Tom Felton, Heather Graham. So there's a good cast there of people.
Mm. Are these people that she has to kind of work her way through? And she's going this
way. Potentially so.
Murderous rampage of revenge, possibly. I haven't seen the film, so
murderous rampage of survival.
Survival.
Maybe,
all right. So she's got to survive the night.
So I think it's not Ready or Not Three.
No. Yeah.
Andy Muschietti described this as a mix of The Raid and Get Out, which I think is a little generous. But
I'm thinking The Raid's in there. There's a bit John Wick-esque thing. And at some points there's RRR. Because I felt it was a bit nonsensical at some points. But when there were some scenes that happened, I thought, okay, I just need to be in the RRR state of mind where I just let it happen.
I feel like if Wes Anderson made The Raid, it would look a bit like
yes,
this.
Yes, yes.
And who did make this? Because we haven't mentioned the director
it's
yet.
It's Kirill Sokolov.
That's right.
Okay.
Who wrote and directed.
This sounds like one of my favourite movies of the year.
It's super gory, but in a very funny way.
Oh, you were awake for this one, were you?
I was very much awake for this. I felt like I was being sprayed with viscera all the way through it. Incredibly gnarly kills in this. Some of them very, very funny. Some brilliantly choreographed fights. It borrows heavily from the Ready or Not playbook, not just in terms of its beats, but also the whole fucking plot. Let's be honest. Yeah, very good. But yeah, just the whole plot. Like, it does feel a bit like, isn't this a film we've seen quite recently, in fact? But you do get past that because it is a lot of fun. But I think for all the action, which works really well, and the choreography, which is great, and the gore, which is fucking gnarly at times, and some of the moments are really inventive, it's maybe a little pedestrian at times. Like, it's not super funny. It's not, the script isn't as tight as the choreography. Patricia Arquette's accent is a thing of...
Is it as bad as Kobe's accent from earlier on?
I mean, I could not tell you where she was from one scene to the next.
I think it's meant to be Irish.
Yeah.
Is it?
I'm
Kobe?
Pretty sure.
I need to... Kirill, I've got some talent.
Cast Kobe in your next film. Yeah, I don't know where she was from, but she's always fun. She seemed to be channeling her Severance character quite a lot during this.
That's
but...
That's... I think what you talk about with the script is part where I struggle with, because I felt for the cast, Patton Joseph is a Shakespearean actor, and I don't felt some of the delivery and line reads could have been as strong as they were, but
they gave out little toy eyeballs at the screening, and you will understand the reason why when you've seen the film.
there is an eyeball that goes for a walk. Yeah. I'm just going to say that. Sold. It's in the trailer.
Yeah. Absolutely sold. This sounds incredible. Five stars?
I wrote this review as well, I'm afraid. I also went three. It's a high, warm three. I had fun. I mean, there's nothing resembling subtext or subtlety about this film. No. The only thing it has is a lot of action gore. And it's basically survived. Yes. It's powered entirely by Zazie Beetz.
See it in the cinema.
You know?
See it in the cinema with a packed crowd.
Yeah, it's people. A lot of fun.
Yeah.
It's
all
a
right.
lot of fun.
This sounds amazing. I'm giving it 5.
Okay,
I haven't seen it, but it sounds great. But we're giving it 3 because we are cowards.
Wow.
And we fools. Are 3 stars then for They Will Kill You. Jimbo, you also stayed awake.
I did.
Largely. Splitsville.
Splitsville, yes. This is Michelangelo Corvino's film, and he directed it. He wrote it with Carl Marvin, much like they did with The Climb, which came out in 2019. And this is a story of infidelity and kind of polyamory and all sorts of things as a lens, really, of examining this friendship between two men. So Carl Marvin plays Kerry, and he is a schlub. He's a schlub. Thank you, Helen.
He's a schlub,
and somehow is married to Adria Arjona. I don't know quite how that's happened, but it has. But they essentially split up in a car journey, which, should we say, goes awry. It goes off the rails slightly, not least of all because their marriage ends during the course of that. He immediately runs to his best friend, Paul, played by Michael Corvino, and his wife, Julie, played by Dakota Johnson. And then to find out, you know, my marriage has just ended. How do you keep your marriage alive? And the way they keep their marriage alive is through a sort of a blend of ethical non-monogamy. And to kind of talk more about where this goes would take away some of its charm, because what's joyful about this film is you have no earthly fucking clue where it's going to go from one scene to the next, because it is pure distilled chaos from top to bottom. There are penis shots. There is genuinely a bit where someone turns to a character and says, why is your penis hanging out? Which is a decent question, I find, most of the time. There's a brilliant sort of, I think it's a oneer actually, but it's a brilliant shot of like a load of, shall we say, I think Harry described them in his review as overlapping lovers, because there's a bit where lots of people are cohabiting. People jump into bed with that person, out of bed, in with that one. There's a mentalist in it. It keeps you on your toes. It keeps you guessing all the way through. But what it does is it keeps this central core, which is this slightly dysfunctional, always entertaining friendship between these two men. One of the high points being at one point they have a, shall we say, disagreement, which is, you talk about choreography.
It's amazing.
Brilliantly choreographed fight in a beautiful lake house, smashing up the furniture, and it is a delight to watch.
Considering we've seen They Will Kill You, which was wall-to-wall fights, this fight in this film was my favourite.
Oh, it's wonderful.
It's fantastic.
It's absolutely wonderful.
You're just watching it thinking, how? Why? Amazing. It's just...
Yeah.
Well, choreographed.
It's a brilliant sequence. I mean, watching them argue with each other is delightful. Dakota Johnson gives the most extraordinary side eye you will ever see. She's brilliant.
The punctuation on that scene with her is amazing. Yeah. She's really good in it.
She's fantastic.
Both men are punching. Adria Arjona and Dakota Johnson.
You can tell they wrote it.
This is why people write and direct films, so they can cast women like that as their wives.
There was genuinely the first scene. I was like, what? With the what now? What is happening here?
But look, I was so entertained by it. It's so well written. Yeah. It's so funny. And like you say, it's really unexpected.
Yeah, there's a novelty to this. Like a lot of films, especially ones dealing with relationships, I think can feel quite formulaic. There is nothing about this that adheres to any formula known to man, and that is its strength.
It's a proper anti-rom-com, isn't it?
Yeah. Mm.
All right. Sounds amazing. We get this one 4 stars. Yes. So by default, we don't do this every week, but it's the film of the week. Well done to Splitsville. Hooray!
Hurrah.
Hooray! And on that note, folks, that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun when we'll be joined by Richard Kind.
Ooh.
Yes, that's right. Richard Kind, the legendary Richard Kind, Bing Bong himself from Inside Out, but obviously so many other incredible credits over the years. He is in town to star for 7 weeks as Max Bialystock in The Producers, and he's coming into the studio to tell us all about that. very excited about that. There may be other people as well. There may be an episode of The Interviews. I don't know. Once again, what do you want from me? Organization? But anyway, on that note, until we meet again, until then, until that auspicious occasion, it is goodbye from my three colleagues of such lethal cunning. James, I've forgotten your nickname this week. What is it? Are you Admirable? Admirable? Are you Admiral? You are Admirable. But are you Admiral James T. Dyer, or are
I'm
you
sticking
the Mad
with
Titan?
The Mad Titan.
The Mad Titan. Yeah. Goodbye from the Mad Titan, James Dyer. It is goodbye from Kobe Omanaka.
Goodbye.
Where are you off to?
I'm going.
Accent camp.
Wow.
All right, Manchester.
Manchester.
Manchester. Yeah. Oh, yeah. All right. And it's goodbye from Helen O'Hara.
Doodles. I'm off to Star Trek night at Science Museum Lit.
Oh, that's very exciting. Yeah.
I now have evening envy. Yeah.
Yes, the Science Museum in London is running a Star Trek at 60 season, and they're showing every Star Trek film, even the bad ones, every Thursday, I think, or at least over the next few months.
Yeah.
They're running some stuff as well, so that's very exciting indeed.
You didn't give me a chance to say that Lisa Kudrow is on the Pilot TV podcast on Monday, as is Elizabeth Moss, who came into this very studio, well, not this one, but the pilot one, to talk to us.
That's exciting.
What a comeback.
What?
Hey.
Very good. She stole my cookies. Not a euphemism.
Oh.
Oh, no.
What would it be a euphemism for?
Ew. That's what Phoebe says. Ew. Smelly cat. Smelly cat.
Oh, look at you. You watch a TV show.
Fuck you.
Well done.
I watch many TV shows, but just ones that usually start with Law and Order. Someone told me Friends was a Law and Order spin-off. That's why I watched all 10 seasons. Jack McCoy doesn't appear once.
Law and Order Central Park.
I was furious. Law and Order Smelly Cat. Anyway, stop talking to me. I'm off now to listen to Gilbert Gottfried's audiobook of The Lord of the Rings. It gets quite spicy halfway through, I must say. Anyway, thanks for listening. See you next time. Bye-bye.
Need a reason to smile? Comfort Dental has you covered with new patient exams, including x-rays, for just $19. That's right, only $19 to get started on a healthier, brighter smile. With convenient locations, flexible hours, including evenings and Saturdays, and a team that truly cares, Comfort Dental makes dental care easy and affordable. No gimmicks, no stress, just quality care when you need it. Get comfortable with Comfort Dental. Call or visit ComfortDental.com today.